Welcome into the Podium Game Podcast. Yesterday, we hit on the best team in the Western Conference with the Warriors. Now we're going to head over to the East and talk about the Atlanta Hawks, joined by Brad Rowland from Peach Street Hoops. I brought down your Twitter. I had everything ready to plug you, and I closed out my tweet deck. So I'm going to get all the necessary information for you out here in a second.
It's all right.
Where do I want to start here? Let's go here. When they hired Budenholzer, what was your thought?
Not knowing a ton about him individually, I guess my thought was, oh good, here comes Pop Disciple. We were individually. I was not a huge fan of the Mike Woodson, Larry Drew era, just especially offensively. Kind of stale, a lot of isolation and stuff. And I from what I heard about Budenholzer and obviously what we know about the Spurs, I was kind of looking forward to a little bit more free-flowing offensively. And knowing how long he had been in San Antonio, was definitely excited to sort of get that influence, along with Ferry, who was already here, to kind of bring that Spurs East mantra that everyone keeps talking about, was kind of what we were all looking forward to when Budenholzer was brought in.
How long did it take for you to start seeing like what they were trying to implement really work over these last 2 years?
It's kind of funny. I mean, we were all pretty excited early last year. I know it's kind of been hashed, but the team was third in the East when Al Horford went down in the middle of the first season. I think they were 16-10, 16-11, something like that. And it wasn't full-fledged like it is now with sort of that really high-end ball-movement offense, but you could sort of see pieces of it right away. But I think the moment that we kind of all knew it was coming was kind of just watching Jeff Teague's development. Teague was a guy who kind of struggled underneath Larry Drew specifically, and was a guy I personally was not sold on. I mean, as recently as like the middle of last season. But sort of having that guy as the engine, as the point guard, and then, of course, having Kyle Korver on board to space the floor and sort of go with that five-out shooting, seeing guys like Paro and Paul Millsap stepping out the three-point line. So it was sort of a slow evolution, but early on, there was sort of bits and pieces of that optimism where you thought this might be a really good offensive team.
Jeff, the original reaction around that contract, I think he got 4 years, $32 million, I'm assuming was mainly negative, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was largely negative. You know, he signed the offer sheet, and the Hawks matched it, 4 for $32 million. And, you know, I wouldn't say it was like the sky is falling or anything like that, but I wasn't thrilled with the idea of giving Teague a four-year contract. Obviously, $8 million isn't, it looks like a bargain at this point, but I kind of felt like it was a slight overpay and probably not one that they were too excited to pick up. But it was right on that line where they couldn't really just let him walk because it was an offer sheet. So they had nobody behind him at the time. So I think it was one of those like swallow hard and hope he keeps developing.
Oh, by the way, Brad, Peachtree Hoops, fan-sided ATLB blog, all places to go see Brad's work.
Yes.
There we go. I knew I had it in there somewhere.
No problem.
Kyle Korver. I mean, he's really good at basketball.
he certainly is very good at basketball. Before we were before we came on, I was sort of looking. Obviously, I see Kyle all the time, but just my favorite stat right now with Korver is the 74.1% true shooting.
That's
for the season.
That's insanity.
And as far as perimeter players are concerned, the closest guy that's qualified in the NBA is Kevin Durant, and it's more than 10 percentage points slower at 63.8% true shooting for the year. Obviously, I mean, everybody knows that he can shoot, but no one thought he was going to shoot like this. You know, with the 50-50, 95, the way he's flirting with it right now. And he's also, you know, he's not just a shooter. Like, he's great moving off the ball. He's a solid defender. He's got great length. You know, he's always in the right spot, good passer. So I know most people think of him as a specialist, and he is a specialist to a certain degree. But, yeah, he's really been incredible all year.
What, how, what were the expectations of Damari Carroll when he signed?
You know, that's a funny one. I was actually a big fan of that contract, but in the same breath, I did not think he was going to be as good as he's been. I think it was 2 years and $5 million total, so $2.5 million a year when he came over. I mean, it was a guy. He was a guy who was, you know, had barely been in a rotation in the NBA previously. I liked him going back to even college as sort of like a length guy with a, you know, pedigree on defense, but no one thought he would shoot like he has. I think is the biggest thing. Like, I know this year he's shooting, I think it's in the somewhere in the mid 30s from three. But last year I think he shot 37% from three, and no one saw that coming. So that's sort of the same thing that they've been able to do with Paul Millsap as well, kind of stretching out everybody's range. I just looked it up. He shot 36% from three last year, and he's almost 40% this year. So that's sort of the dimension no one saw coming. I liked the deal a lot, but I thought he might be, you know, sort of a really sort of miniature version of what he's been, a solid defender, sort of extreme role player who would come in and kind of lock down the best perimeter player on the other team. But him developing into a full-time starter at this level was something I didn't really see coming.
How have you seen Al Horford's game pick up over the last couple weeks?
I think the biggest thing with Al is on defense. You know, I've always been a huge fan of Horford, but, you know, missing basically not a full year, but close to it after he missed basically another full year a couple years ago. There was a lot of rust early on, especially defensively. You could sort of see a little bit of hesitancy on that end, not wanting to really scrap or really sort of extend to protect the rim. But in the last, you know, I think about, I would say 6 weeks to 2 months, somewhere in there, that's really picked up. And it's not a coincidence that the Hawks are, I think, the best team in the league defensively since December 1st and over the course of this run. And a lot of that is Horford sort of being much more active. He's not a pure shot blocker. I think he's averaging like 1.3 blocks a game, something like that. But he is super rangy. He can really cover our pick and rolls, and he's sort of the focal point of the backline defense. I know a lot of people don't like that the Hawks don't have the quote unquote true center, but Horford is definitely more than a capable center on that end, and he's with the exception of a very few matchups, he's very good on that end, especially now that he's sort of knocked the rust off.
Well, why do him and Millsap complement each other so well?
I think it's that they can both sort of play in and out. And I know Mike Budenholzer talks about it all the time, where they're sort of interchangeable parts, really versatile. Horford's really good offensively in the pick and pop game. He's a great shooter from, like, you know, 15 to 18 feet. And Millsap can also step out as well, but they both also are good around the rim. Especially Millsap, he's so crafty around the rim, kind of creating angles, little flip shots. Horford's got an underrated post game, a really nice hook shot when he wants to take it. The Hawks don't run a lot of post-ups because they don't need to. It's not really their system. But because they can both play inside and out, they really play off each other well. They're both really good passers, even in high-low stuff. I just think the way the offense flows, that they both fit so well in the grand scheme that them playing together just automatically works.
What's the part of this team that you just enjoy the most? We see all of Hawks Twitter there every night. You guys just seem like you're having a blast at these games. But what aspect of all of this is most fun for you?
Yeah, we do have a good time. I know myself and Bo Cherney and Robbie Callen and Chris Willis, we definitely have fun. My favorite part of this team is the ball movement. I'm sort of a basketball purist in that sense, and the ball just zings on this team. Obviously, the team, the outsiders sort of kill the Hawks for not having that quote-unquote go-to guy, but the way the ball moves, the way everybody's so unselfish. We talked to Kyle Korver last night even, you know, about how much fun this team's having. Just, it's that thing about they all feel like they could shoot on any possession, and they play so unselfishly. Everybody's willing to pass. It's the extra passes. One guy's got an open shot. The other guy's, you know, you got Korver in the corner, so let's have him shoot that wide open shot instead of me. They're having fun. I mean, watching the bench reactions, talking about Kent Bazemore, Mike Muscala kind of developed a little bit of a reputation for having a lot of fun on the bench. And I think they just like each other. and it's fun to watch, especially in a team that plays like a really aesthetically pleasing brand of basketball on top of that.
A fair warning to Brad and the listeners, the dogs in my house are probably going to make an appearance on this podcast shortly. Just fair warning for everyone when you hear barking in the background. So, I mean, 38-8, 17 in a row. Like, this is getting really crazy. How good did you think they were going to be coming into the season?
Yeah, nobody saw 38-8, and if they tell you they did, they're lying. But I want to say I was pretty optimistic against sort of the norm elsewhere. I think I picked them for, I think it was 48 or 49 wins in the preseason and wherever I wrote that. I thought like, you know, low 50s was probably the apex, which clearly looks like that was on the low side now. But I was optimistic that they would be somewhere in that 3-6 seed range in the East. You know, everybody sort of penciled in Chicago and Cleveland in the 1-2. But I thought they would be somewhere in that group with Washington, Toronto, in that, you know, 3-5, 3-6 range. And I thought, like, it has sort of taken time with Horford coming back. It might take a little bit of time to gel. Obviously, I didn't see 17 in a row coming. But I think the moment that I sort of figured out that this team was real, they had a 5-game stretch in December. I think they started at 16-7, where they were going to see Chicago, Cleveland, Houston, Dallas, and the Clippers in a row. And we were sort of talking amongst ourselves, like, maybe they can go 2-3, 3-2 in that stretch, and they won all five. And it was sort of that look around, like, is this team really this good? And then, you know, from there they've lost once since that run started. So it's sort of the dream ride right now. And I don't think they're as good as 38-8. It would be sort of misleading to say that, but it certainly looks like this is definitely real, and I did not see that part coming.
I stopped gambling a while ago, but I have a friend who still does, and I always tell him, I was like, I'm terrible at game-to-game stuff, like lines at night. Please just don't ask me, because you're going to ask me, I'm going to be wrong. But I've always been pretty good at over-unders. The Hawks were, I got him to bet the Hawks and the Rockets. The Hawks are at 41. They're going to hit it before the All-Star break.
Yeah, I mean, that's I do follow that stuff too. It was a big topic of conversation at Summer League in Vegas this summer. Sort of people couldn't figure out why the Hawks over under was so low. Like, it was almost like, what does Vegas see that we're not seeing? But yeah, that was, I mean, it would have been one of my favorite picks of the preseason for sure, at 41 or 42, wherever it ended up at. And yeah, I mean, the fact that they're going to cruise past it by the All-Star break is pretty funny in itself. But, yeah, it did seem comically low in the preseason. But you never know what those things. Sometimes Vegas is smarter than everybody else.
So in last year in the Pacers series, the crowd was fun, but it was more like a college crowd with a lot of fans from both teams. I've been reading about how the attendance is up. Is the momentum in Atlanta for supporting the team, is that finally starting to grow, or is it a lot of mixed crowds still?
It really is. That's been one of the coolest things. I almost mentioned that earlier, of sort of the transition between Atlanta's got this reputation, and it's well earned, for having all these crowds with, you know, 50-50 or even sometimes more than that splits toward the visiting team. Like in the past, you know, when Miami would come, you'd have 70% Heat fans because they'd all be geared up to try to get in the building, and the eruptions when LeBron would score and that kind of stuff. I think it's 8 sellouts in the last 10 games at home, which is unheard of by Hawks standard. I know a lot of cities sell out almost every game, but that's not been the case in Atlanta in the recent past. And really, it's been a lot of Hawks. I mean, mostly Hawks fans. It's sort of odd. We were there last night for Brooklyn, and in the past that would have been a game where I thought, you know, we're going to see some opposing fans, and it was loud from the jump, and basically, you know, all pro Hawks, and it was really a nice atmosphere, especially for, you know, a Wednesday game in January.
There's no Nets fans. They don't exist.
Oh, I know, but, you know, it's one of those things where you know, Joe Johnson's coming back, and I don't know. This the whole. I just always expect there to be visiting team fans. It's kind of what we're built. We're built up. Even teams like Minnesota, they were here Sunday, and I'm thinking, you know, normally it wouldn't be anything of a good crowd on a Sunday night, and the place was packed. It was. It's sort of the city's definitely on board, and I kind of wonder what it'll be like after they finally lose a game. You know, because they've won 17 in a row. But with the momentum, I think it's even, you know, sports radio, local TV, everybody's sort of buzzing on the Hawks right now. It's really nice to see.
You mentioned Joe Johnson. Is there an appreciation of what those Josh Smith, Joe Johnson, Horford teams accomplished, or are they looked at negatively?
We were actually talking about this last night with Joe and Tom. I don't think there's too much of an appreciation. I think there's a knowledge that, you know, the team is in the playoffs, you know, basically every year. I mean, I think it's the Hawks have the second longest playoff streak in the NBA behind the Spurs, which no one really knows, but they've been in the playoffs every year for, you know, almost a decade now. But it wasn't fun basketball. Like, I'm actually a big Joe Johnson fan and kind of probably always will be. He gets the bad rap for signing the big contract, as if he wasn't supposed to sign the max contract that was handed to him. I never understand that. But Joe was really good here. I mean, I've never been a big Josh Smith fan, but he was really good here for the most part. And those teams won. I mean, they made a second round a couple times. Like, they were definitely respectable. But yeah, it's not unless outside of the diehards, it's not like there's a big appreciation for what they did, despite, you know, a pretty decent amount of success.
That playoff streak lives on because in the midst of an extremely long losing streak last year, the one game the Hawks won was against the Knicks.
Oh, absolutely! I was there, and in the interest of full disclosure, I was rooting for the Hawks to miss the playoffs last year after the Horford injury. I think the Hawks lost 14 out of 15 games in the middle of the year, and that Knicks was the one win. But I can't speak for anybody else, but I was rooting for them to miss the playoffs to get the shot at the lottery and sort of giving the team no chance to advance in the playoffs. And it's definitely come a long way from there. And I didn't see the playoff series with Indiana being as competitive as it was, but that was sort of fun too. Just kind of watching that team compete and watching Budenholzer, you know, put in work to keep that team afloat in a 7-game series they had no business hanging around in. So it was kind of. That's probably a little bit of the impetus for this year, too, sort of the city sort of seeing that this is a fun team. Like, they're going to shoot threes, they're going to play fast, and we're going to have fun. But, yeah, I was rooting against them down the stretch.
Yeah, because they split the season series 2-2. So if the Knicks win that game, they would have won the season series, they would have been tied, and the Knicks would have made the playoffs over the Hawks. That's crazy.
Yeah, I remember that game well, too. We sat, me and Robbie Callen and Chris Herring were sitting around because there was actually a post-game concert at Phillips Arena. So we were sitting there trying to wait out traffic and talking about, you know, this one might matter at the end of the year. And it did. The Hawks, that was the one the Hawks stole, and they ended up going to the playoffs.
Hopefully it was a country music concert.
It was definitely not a country music concert.
Would that not fit in Atlanta?
It would have, but not really the Hawks crowd necessarily. I can't remember what the concert was, but it was. I don't think it was country.
I was in Atlanta when Michigan played in the Final Four. Did you go to those games?
I went to the final. I didn't go to the semifinal. I was out of town. I watched it, and I came. Me and my dad went to the Monday. I know we're both Michigan fans, but yeah, that was one of my least favorite sporting experiences live. I mean, obviously, it's cool to be there when your team's there, especially when you live in the city that it's being held in for me, which worked out good for me. But yeah, not too fun with the end result.
It was what really hurt is because in the first half, it was like, "Holy shit, we're gonna win this game!" When Spike went off, and then I was upset.
Oh no, I feel this. I mean. You know, Trey Burke played, I think, 4 minutes in the first half or something. And yeah, there's a million things we could pick apart from that one. But yeah, it looked like we were going to win for a little bit there when Spike went crazy. But yeah, that's one that I'll certainly never forget being in the building for.
The Syracuse game was fun. That it was really cool being in that place when they won. That was a crazy experience that I I really appreciate. How excited are you for Harbaugh?
Very. I'm very excited for Harbaugh. It's funny, I wrote a whole column about it, but I wasn't excited for Harbaugh way before it happened.
Yeah, I couldn't believe you.
I kind of had to be talked into that one. I guess it probably didn't take much to talk me into it, but I think it was more of the I'm not sure he'll stay for more than 4 years thing at the beginning. But once I saw like he took the $5 million contract instead of the $7 million contract, and he seems like he's all in for the return of the alma mater. So yeah, I was a quick convert on that one. I'm pretty excited about it.
I'm shocked that you were able to be talked into Jim Harbaugh being the coach of the college football team you root for.
Yeah, really. It seems so silly now that I was against it, but yeah, I came around in a hurry.
Super Bowl prediction.
I'll take the Pats. I know you're not in the tank for Brady like I am, but Michigan guy, Brady, I trust Belichick. They're sort of in FU mode now, I think, too. And anybody you want to be in FU mode, it's probably the Pats. So I'll take the
And on that note, we'll wait out the dog barking. Our friend Stoli over here wanted to make the appearance on the podcast, and we'll let you plug what you have to before getting out of here.
Yeah, I mean, if for Hawk stuff, I mean, Peachtree Hoops, doing good work over there, and Fansided, just sort of doing columns pretty much every day of the week on something, NBA, NFL, college football, sort of all across the board there, but nothing super in particular right now. Yeah, but the Hawks are rolling, so
you're able to get people to click on your Fansided stuff. I was awful and couldn't get any clicks. Yeah, that happened. All right, Brad.
I have to beg for it. But, you know.
That's what I didn't do. I didn't beg enough. All right, Brad, thank you very much. Make sure you go check out everything he does. That wraps up this portion of the Podium Game Podcast. We're going to go around the rest of the NBA coming up real quick here next. All right, we just finished up talking about the Hawks. Now we're going to go hit on the rest of the NBA with Andy Liu from multiple places. He writes over at Upside Motor. He does some work for HP. And what's the name of the Warriors site you write for with SB Nation?
GoldenStateOfMind.com.
GoldenStateOfMind.com. So make sure you go check all of his work out at any of those places. He does a really good job. First off, I have to ask. I got your request for – I taped these through Skype, and your name involves lard cakes. I think you have to explain that.
Oh, man. I thought it was just my name, but I guess middle school never ends, does it?
No, but, I was very – I definitely chuckled, so I thought it would be good to get the background from that.
I don't know if you've ever watched the Napoleon Dynamite. It's an older movie. It's kind of a weird. I don't know how to explain it. It's a comedy, but it's a little odd. And they had this one line where he goes up and he's feeding a cow, and he just goes and he just screams like in the weirdest voice. He just goes like, "Tina, you fat lard! Here's your food." And I was a little chubby then, so I said, you know. Might as well, and then 21's my favorite number. So,
see,
it's a little embarrassing that came up.
No, I had to. I saw that. I was like, "Oh, that's great. I really like that name," but I had no idea where it was from. I have seen Napoleon Dynamite. Very fun. It's very dry. I think is how I would describe it.
Yeah, it's a little weird. I think that was like the first movie like comedy-ish, that kind of dryness or sarcasm or that I've ever watched. And if you guys got recommendations for anything else, I would love to see something similar to that.
So I just embarrassed myself on Twitter. Katy Perry is in Arizona, and I let her know that I live in Arizona, that she's here for Super Bowl. If she wanted somewhere to shotgun beers and jump off tables, I was here to help her.
Oh, I saw that. That was amazing.
So I'm hoping she responds by the end of the weekend.
Oh, I didn't even know the Super Bowl was in Arizona, huh?
Yeah. Did you just completely check out once the 49ers didn't make the playoffs?
See, but the weird thing is I'm rooting for the Seahawks. It's weird. It's all this Marshawn Lynch stuff is I'm just, you know what, I hope he just scores three touchdowns and does his thing and just, you know, I hope he wins MVP. I don't know. It's weird. I want them to win their set. And the Niners are kind of a mess right now, so I'm kind of, you know, don't tell any of the Niners fans, but I'm kind of seeping over there a little bit.
I'm rooting for the stadium to fall into a big sinkhole.
Dark Knight style.
Yeah, that would be perfect. Exactly. Except no one dies. Just a sinkhole, and then everyone can come back up, but the game can't be played, and neither team can win. Like, that's optimal.
Oh, man, you're not a football fan either, huh?
No, I'm a Jets fan. So,
well, that's rough.
Patriots, yeah. And then I'm a weird person who I absolutely despise Russell Wilson.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's too nice.
Yeah, it seems kind of fake, right? I've gotten that a lot. I've heard that a lot.
Yeah, he's too nice. And he texts with Katy Perry. I found that out on Twitter today.
It's just a jealousy thing, I guess.
Yeah, but I disliked him before I found that about that, to be fair to me. All right, you are here to talk about basketball. Yeah. Not Napoleon Dynamite, the NFL, but thanks for Jim Harbaugh, by the way. We had the first person who was on, Brad Rowland, is also a Michigan fan, so we talked about him for a little bit. So thank you. I appreciate it.
It's going to be great for you guys. So I didn't know you were a Michigan fan. Oh, that's going to be great for you guys.
Yeah, I really appreciate the 49ers being stupid. It was fantastic. A team that hasn't been stupid recently, the Cavaliers, they decided to start playing well again. They've won 9 straight. And I don't know, most people coincide that with LeBron James coming back. I think it has everything to do with J.R. Smith.
You know, what is he averaging right now? Like 8, 9 threes a game? And he's hitting them at, what, 40%? And they're all wide open.
It's perfect for him.
Yeah, and there was the thing that came out yesterday that said he was able to focus because he couldn't go out at night. So I guess he hasn't met Manziel yet, or I don't know what's going on over there. But hey, whatever's working for them. It's weird because they've pretty much gone all in, right? Relatively, they got Mozgov, who is a good center, and they're still using Kevin Love, right? And I know you're going to bring up the Kyrie Irving game soon. I think it all comes back to LeBron being just LeBron, and it pretty much. No matter what you put around LeBron, if he's who he is, like the Miami LeBron, or even pre-Miami Cleveland LeBron, you really can't do any wrong. They're going to be fine, especially in such a terrible conference.
That's where, and I ended up, I was wrong about this. It was very clear after he took the 2 weeks off. It seems like his struggles, and it wasn't even struggles, it was that he went from being like one of the greatest players in history to just being like a normal top 5 NBA player. And with that, you can't just throw anything together and it's going to work. When he's playing like LeBron historically has, it doesn't matter who's on the team, as you said, and he can kind of pull off anything. So I was wrong. I kind of thought he was in a decline, but no.
Yeah, which is weird. I mean, really? That's all it took was 2 weeks? It's kind of like, and he said, I think he said he was in chill mode for a game until the end. I believe it was against the Magic. And it's hard to believe that 2 weeks was really all it took for him to look like himself after almost, 25, 30 games of just looking like a average top 5 player, like you said, which is insane when he's at 80%, he's just still destroying the competition, but obviously not himself.
Yeah, it was a really weird situation. Kyrie, 50, that might have been, I think that was the most impressive win the Cavs had this year, I would think, because they did it without LeBron. Kevin Love didn't really give them much in that game, and yep. Kyrie scoring, like, I talked about this with Ethan on the previous podcast with Clay. When Clay goes off, it just kind of seems easy. It's just like him being longer and taller, and he just is an awesome shooter, and he makes a bunch of shots. Like, for Kyrie to get 55 points, like, it looks like he really had to work for that. And he hit some crazy shots in that game. It was really fun to watch.
Yeah, that was – and I'm not a Kyrie fan, and he's young, so I mean, I'm sure I'll jump back on when he's really awesome. And that game was just rewatching the game. There was, I think, what Kyrie's criticism, at least for me, was that he doesn't really look to pass and he doesn't defend, which is fine. But I think from LeBron's point of view, that's pretty much perfect. That's pretty much what he wants. He wants Kyrie to just do what he did yesterday. It's get the ball and score the ball. Like, forget being whatever a pure point guard is or any of that stuff, right? Just forget about all that. Just score. Don't worry about getting Kevin Love on pick and pops. Don't worry about getting Jarrett Smith the ball or anything. Like, I think LeBron is happy about just having someone that'll pick up the load for him, because he might not have to score 35, 10, and 10 every single game, especially in the playoffs. So it's still weird for me that Kevin Love would still be used in such a way that doesn't really maximize what he does, but this maximizes what Kyrie Irving does. Yeah. And the finishes that he had over who was it yesterday? Who was he going against?
He had one over King.
Aldridge and the yeah. So he was just finishing right over him, and it was just, oh man, yeah. It works. I think it's good for the Cavs in terms of LeBron has another scorer. I'm just still not so sure about the long term. But forget that. That was a great performance.
Yeah, I don't know if I wouldn't call Kyrie the best finisher around the rim in the NBA, just because he has some physical limitations that bigger guys have an easier time doing it. But he might be the most unique and most creative.
Yeah, I think, and I'm a huge, Steph Curry is my favorite player. I think Kyrie's a better ball handler and a better finisher than Steph Curry. And Steph Curry's gotten a lot better at finishing. He does a little, like, you know, reverses and whatnot. But I think Kyrie's on another level when it comes to just being shifty with the ball. And sometimes he just goes in with a left-handed crossover, and he just goes up, like, the top of the bank. Ball is left hand only. And it's just, I don't know any other player in the league that can do that.
What makes Steph and Kyrie so much fun is they both have a little street ball to their game, and they can do it within the context of making it work in the NBA. That makes it's cool to watch.
Yeah, and the thing about, I don't know how Kyrie is. I don't follow the team daily, but Steph seems like a really humble person when he talks to the media and whatnot. Man, he's cocky. When he gets on the floor, he knows he's the best player on the floor when he's on there, and he'll do stuff that'll kind of, you know, try to embarrass guys. And I think Kyrie's kind of the same way. And that, you know, that's what you need if you know and you're going to be one of the best players.
And it was like the game winner. Yes, I hate when guys take three pointers in tie games on the final possession. It bothers me. But he just pulled up in Batum's face and drilled it. And he did that throughout the game. He was hitting threes over Batum. He had a couple over Aldridge from deep. And he has such a good arc on his shot that he just, even though he's smaller, if you just give him a little bit of space, he can get it up over these longer guys.
Yeah, he's kind of a guy where shooting off the dribble doesn't scare you. Like, you get, like, you know, Kyle Korver doesn't shoot off the dribble, right? Because he's just so good just shooting it, catching and shooting, which is fine. And Steph Curry is another guy that shoots or is more comfortable shooting off the dribble. And I think Kyrie, like, you don't mind him doing that. He's still so lethal, having the ball in his hand the whole time and still shooting. And, you know, we debate about hero ball all the time, but, oh, man, I know, like everyone else, I would rather have a team, you know, pass around the ball or look for the best shot. But in that situation, a guy has 50 at that point, and you know he's going to jack it up. You're like, you know what, forget making the right play, just, you know. Because if it goes in, you know it's going to be awesome.
It was like, you know, it's funny you bring that up. It's at the end of the Bulls game, the Warriors ran a couple really nice sets and got good looks, and they drew a foul on the Iguodala play. That was a really well-designed play. They got Clay a wide-open. They kind of got Clay multiple wide-open looks. Yep. He could have taken the three. He probably should have tried to get a little bit, like, a more normal layup. And he ended up with a weird in-between shot. But I kind of miss, like, Steph Curry just getting the ball and going.
See that's another thing where the offense last year for the Warriors was just that, giving the ball to Steph Curry and watching him go. And I think before that, D-Rose actually took an awful fadeaway long two jumper that he made, which turned out to be awesome. But I think the thing for that is when you're the Warriors, you're trying to run the play for like a backdoor or something like for Iguodala. There are so many variables in the play. They had Steph going backdoor, but I think either Spates or Draymond didn't pass it. So that you need two people to figure that out. And for D. Rose, it's just one. You know, and Iguodala getting the ball down low, you kind of don't want him getting fouled, right? You don't want him shooting free throws. For some reason, he can't shoot free throws now. So that, you know, that's another variable where you need everything to go right, when in D. Rose's case or Kyrie Irving's case, it's just one person shooting. It might not be the best shot, but yeah, you know, it worked out for them.
From one of LeBron's teammates to his old teammate, Dwayne Wade is once again out indefinitely. Now, so last year he played 54 games. The year before that, 69 games. That was 12-13 the strike year, or was 11-12 the strike year?
Oh, was it? Man, I don't even know right now.
I get confused by these things, damn it. Let me see. Let me click here real quick to make sure we are being factually accurate.
2011 NBA.
So 2011. So yeah. that he missed a large amount of games there, and then he only played 49 in 11-12. So, I mean, he missed nothing about this is surprising with Wade. And you feel kind of bad because he's played well when he's been on the court this season.
Yeah, it's weird. He kind of just fell apart, right? I mean, we all thought it was going to happen, but not to the extent where they kind of also got screwed over, where they had to draft Shabazz Napier and Chris and Josh McRoberts is now out for season, and for some reason Chris Bosh isn't protecting the rim now anymore. So it's kind of gone back to relying on Dwayne Wade. I think back when Wade was by himself, he had that one series against the Boston Celtics where I think it was a gentleman's sweep, but he won one game basically by himself. And they're pretty much relying on that D Wade now just to get into the playoffs. And it's just a mess. I don't really know what they can do beyond the fact that last year's they had a little program for Wade last year, which worked out fine, but only because LeBron was there, you know, wearing himself down, carrying the team all the way. So it's rough for the Heat because there's nothing you can look forward to, I don't think.
Well, on Tom Whiteside.
Yes. Oh, that's right. Hassan Whiteside, the new franchise center, right?
Yeah, well, the next Will Chamberlain.
Yeah, he's looked great, though. I think I was talking to Ethan. He was saying how he didn't really know what to do on the offensive end and stuff like that. But I think pretty much he kind of does what people wanted Larry Sanders to do, basically, was on offense, was just to set screens and roll to the rim and attract two people, right? And on defense, he's just... That game where he had 12 blocks, he was blocking jumpers, Anthony Davis style, weak side blocks, ISO blocks. I think that's one building block for them, I think. But it's rough if D-Wade isn't going to be D-Wade anymore. And that's something that doesn't seem like it's going to happen.
I really liked your comparison there. Maybe if Hassan Whiteside becoming what we all kind of wanted Larry Sanders to be, that's something that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, because what they really need from them is Chris Bosh to just take over on that offensive end. But it doesn't look like I don't know if you've been watching them, but has there been a little something different about him this season?
I think Bosh is just he's a good solid. I think my thing with Bosh is I don't want him to be the best player on my team, but I think he's probably the one of the best complementary pieces in the NBA. Like, if you have a LeBron James and you can have Bosh play off him, he's absolutely perfect. If you had prime Dwayne Wade and you have Bosh playing off him, he's perfect. But I no longer think you want Bosh to be your number one guy that you're building your offense around.
Yeah, he's not Kevin Love in the way that he plays. I think he's probably a little better, but kind of in that vein, I guess, of being a guy that is good enough to have a team maybe in the playoffs in the East, but not good enough to where he can carry someone. I don't know. I think that's a weird way to to think about it in terms of, because we all thought Bosch was going to be back to Toronto Bosch when he came back, when he signed that max contract. And I think he wanted to do that too, but then I think he realized where everything came really easy, or not easy, but everything worked out really well, at least in terms of shooting and a defensive structure where they could blitz the ball and he would be able to rotate. But now it's sort of like they don't have that, the athletes, the talent. And I think Spoelstra is still a really good coach, but it's just not it's not possible for them to play that the way that they did, which really hurts him.
And there's nothing wrong with it's not an insult to Bosch that he can't be one of those guys. There's a finite number of people who can actually pull off being able to do that. So he's still a Hall of Fame player no matter what. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just kind of a fact of where he is at this point in his career. Another team that isn't exactly clicking, we'll head over to the Western Conference, the Dallas Mavericks. They are 11-9 since Rondo came over, but only 11. He missed one of those games. He missed a loss at Denver in the middle of January. So 11-8 with him in the lineup. Has it gone as you expected, worse or better?
I think just about what I expected, right? I believe they're on and off a little bit better defensively when he's on the court. And the people that were saying he would be a perfect fit with Monte Ellis, kind of like a offense first guard and then a defense first guard, I think that was never going to work out, especially at least to peak levels, at least for that team with the construction around them. But I think they had to make the move. If you're kind of debating whether it was a good move or not, because when they had the team, their number one offense, and I think they slipped to two or three, they kind of had to make the move in the Western Conference. I think the Western Conference kind of forces you to make moves that you might not be comfortable with. Like, I'm not sure if Houston really wanted Josh Smith, but the upside was that he would be able to bring something more to the table, especially with Terrence Jones out. And I think for Rondo, I think they wanted the upside of him being able to defend and maybe becoming the Rondo that was in Boston, even though he hadn't been that player before. I think he even said that he wasn't trying as hard, which is ironic since people love calling him like a tough-nosed guy that's a competitor and whatnot. But I think in the Western Conference, they had to make that move, especially if Dirk is in his final seasons.
Yeah, I didn't. When you consider what they gave up for him, it was definitely worth a shot, because I don't know what else around the league you're really getting for that. I mean, Brandon Wright ended up basically getting traded for 2 second-round picks. So Brandon Wright's a nice player, but he was the best guy they traded plus a protected pick. They really didn't give up a lot to get him. The fit with Ellis is always going to be a little bit awkward because they both need the ball in their hands to be successful. But come playoff time, if it makes them better defensively, typically better defenses do better in the playoffs than the better offenses, even though in best case scenario you want to be a well-balanced team, that now they profile as a team that would have more success versus the team they were with Jameer Nelson running the point.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is they're pretty much relying on Carlisle to throw out some schemes that he's not going to do in the regular season for the playoffs, right? Kind of like what he did last year for the San Antonio Spurs. Work is magic, so to speak, I guess, for a fit I'm more optimistic for this fit for the Mavs. And I think Parsons has not been that great this year. And as long as they can keep Chandler, though, and Nowitzki healthy, I think they're maybe a little better than Houston in probably the second tier. And I like the Mavs team. I really like Carlisle, so I'm probably biased.
Do you think they're better or worse than Portland?
Probably better. I think I think I liked him better in terms of, I think in the playoffs, I think LaMarcus Aldridge, I'm jumping around here, but I think for Aldridge as a player, is a little bit overrated. I think when the teams hit tough, like you said, defenses are better or have to be better. And I think they sort of scheme in the way that they'll let him shoot those mid-range fall-away jumpers as much as he wants, because the offense is predicated around him being in the fulcrum point in the middle, and everybody will shoot threes around him. So I think that's easier to stop than the Mavs, who have a gorgeous flow offense.
That's my thing with Aldridge also. And let's be clear, he's been incredible since coming back. In the two games since he decided to put off the thumb surgery on his offhand, he has 64 combined points and 20 rebounds. But the thing with him is, and he's actually, in these two games, he's gotten to the free throw line 18 times, but he typically is more of like a get to the line five times a night guy, four or five times a night versus the 8-9. And as good as he is, what happens is he's still wasting. You're losing, if he's just shooting at his typical level, you're losing 11 possessions a game. Now, he also doesn't turn the ball over, so you rather have shots than guys turning the ball over. But that's a lot of wasted possessions for shots that aren't exactly great. So, as you said, if you have a guy who can defend him one-on-one, which not a lot of teams do,
right,
you just concentrate on taking away the three-point line and you let him take 30 shots a game, unless he's shooting some incredible percentage, the math is typically going to work out in your favor.
Yeah, and I think the Spurs did that really well last season, too. They kind of just let him do his thing, and they pretty much canceled out Lillard, Matthews, and Batum. And also, it's not really helping that Batum's kind of fallen off because he's kind of always injured, which is, I think he had a hand injury last season. His wrist is hurt again now, and that's rough for them. And I don't know how sustainable this is for Aldridge, especially if he's already, you know, if his thumb is already messed up. But when you're talking about it from how teams will try to take that away, I think I don't know how much you can build that offense around. I think they should. Kind of how the Warriors kind of use Steph's gravity, so to speak. I think that's the term that everybody uses now. His gravity to kind of leverage that to get other players open shots. I think maybe if they kind of veered and balanced it both ways, it would work. I'm just not sure how much they'll change it up if they're still going to be successful, because they're still a pretty damn good team in the regular season.
At the bottom of the West, you have the Suns at 27-20. They are two games up in the loss column on the Pelicans. They are three games up on the loss column on the Thunder. Now, the Thunder lost to the Knicks on Wednesday night. That's not good. That's the first time. Look, I wrote a story for the Phoenix, the Suns SB Nation site, about 3 weeks ago at this point, basically saying the Suns should forget about the playoffs and concentrate on developing some of their young players for the future. After that game against the Knicks, that's the first time I was like, the Thunder really might not make the playoffs.
Yeah, and I think some of it is just that the Thunder really might not be good this season. It's even with KD, even with Westbrook, and with Ibaka, they just might not be good or like great.
It's so weird to me, though, because, look at it last year. They've upgraded from Adams to – Adams is better than Perkins, and now Perkins is playing in a role that makes more sense for him, and he's actually playing a little bit better this year, too. But you have Adams eating up the majority of those minutes at the center position. They're also playing some small ball lineups. They still have something's just a little weird there. I don't think it's a talent thing. They still have tons and tons of talent. It's just not all clicking like it has in the past.
And and I think, and I know we all love, I don't know where you stand on this, but I know we all love to blame Scott Brooks, right? And it's, some of us love to defend Scott Brooks, but I think it's one of those things where, look, the system worked really great when Russell and KD were playing. And I think I came around on it. I thought the ISOs were fine as long as they were playing. But now when you're talking about guys being out and with both or one or the other, and that's going to happen. So you can either say, look, KD is out. They're not going to be good. But there's a certain point where Jeremy Lamb has got to give you something, and Reggie Jackson has got to give you something at a certain point. Serge Ibaka has got to give you something beyond just shooting jumpers. And maybe that's unfair, given that KD showed her so much and he's the MVP and Westbrook is who Westbrook is. But it seems that without one or the other, they're just so lost on either end that it's kind of hard to not blame Scott Brooks for some of this, because they're just not very good when the superstars are, which is obvious. But you would think after all these years, they would have some type of fallback plan for this. But it's rough to watch.
I mean, we've seen what the Spurs have done without their players. Dallas has played through injuries in the past. Chicago does it all. The Bulls do it all the time. I mean, that's part of what the Raptors got through. Okay, they weren't great, and they're in a crappier conference, but they managed without DeRozan. Oh, that's part of the job description for what these guys are, is to, when things aren't at their best, you have to figure out a way to, you look, no one's going to expect you to win 70% of your games like you do when Westbrook, Ibaka, and Durant are all healthy. But if he could have kept them at 500 during that time, and I can't, you know what, it's so, the games when Westbrook and Durant were both out, that it's unfair to ask him to win those, but as long as he has one of those guys, there should be some expectation of you should still be able to be a functioning basketball team.
Yeah, it's just rough because the system works out where he's capital and he's maximizing the guys that he has when he has them. He's not asking Lamb or whoever to do stuff that he doesn't want them to do, even when their team is great. So I think maybe, and you know, from someone who doesn't really know that much about coaching, but you know, some teams, like, I hate to keep going back to the team that I root for, but kind of like the Warriors. When they're winning, and when they're winning big, they kind of just throw guys in there just to see who they have and kind of develop them doing different things. Like that's what they've done for Justin Holiday like you said, the Spurs. But the Spurs are kind of like an extreme example. They're a dynasty. They do what they do. But I think maybe maximizing everything that they've gotten from those three pillars that they've had has kind of hurt the development of everyone else. Because the other guys really haven't had to do anything out of their comfort zone. So when they're asked to step up, it's kind of, maybe it's one of those things where they don't know what they're doing, and now it's kind of hurt the Thunder.
And the Warriors are another good example of teams that have won. They've been able to win games this year without Bogut when most of us all, I've kind of expected them to take a dip when Bogut wasn't there. I know you're at work and you have to go do the things you get paid for. So do you have anything you want to plug before you get out of here?
Not much. You pretty much hit it off the spot, right, for Harvard Proxism and Golden State of Mind. And, you know, and I know you write for Knickerbocker, right?
Yes, I do.
You guys are hilarious. I mean,
Don't put me in the category of any of those guys. Those guys are 300 times better than anything I ever do. I take no credit for any of that.
Humility, I like it. But I hate rooting against the Knicks. But, man, when you guys lose close and awful games, Twitter is a riot, man. It's just,
there's a lot of us on there, yes.
Man, it's brutal, but it's fun for me. I'm sorry.
I really prefer the Knicks be good. Like, that's like this recent, like, they've won 4 out of 5, and if Melo would have played in the other game, they probably would have won 5 in a row. Like, I know the best thing for them is to lose and guarantee themselves the top 3 pick or the top 4 pick with one of the worst or second worst records in the league, but it's really fun watching the team you root for win.
Yeah.
It's much more enjoyable.
But I mean, okay, but you're used to this for a while, but with the tanking thing, are you rooting? I know Lakers fans are rooting for the tank. Like, they're making this like a kind of a joke, like, you know, tank squad and all that. I know when the Warriors were tanking for Harrison Barnes, we did the same thing. I don't know, maybe you guys are just sick of it by now. Like, you know, just forget tanking, forget all of this. We just want to see some decent basketball being played. So we're just not a total embarrassment. Is that kind of a thing for you guys? Or
Me personally, there's a lot of people who are all in on the tanking, and I was there for a while. I've kind of changed my mindset. What I kind of want to see, I basically looked, if they go 500 the rest of the season, they still only win 27 games. You're going to get a good pick even if you do that. But I think they shut down Melo after the All-Star break, but while they're playing them, I think it would be good to show that they can be a competent basketball team, so when during free agency this summer, they can go, listen, when Melo was playing, we had these guys, we picked up some guys that could play defense, we were a more well-balanced roster. We have a program that we know can be successful and can work, and we can put together some wins. So we have this to show free agents that we can do this. But then after the All-Star break, I want Melo to shut it down, and I want them to lose every game possible.
I mean, I don't think I've been. I'm a little too young to remember when the Knicks were good, so I don't know. But I've heard that MSG is one of the best home courts in the NBA when they're good. So I mean, that would be nice.
I've always thought MSG is a little bit overrated. When you're talking about the best of the best with NBA crowds. You see Oracle, you have
Toronto,
the Thunder, those places are rocking all the time. MSG is like a slightly better Staples. They'll get up for big moments, but like at the beginning of games, like a random game in the middle of December, it's going to be really quiet unless it gets close at the end. They're not, getting up rocking the entire game. So, if that makes sense, it's a little bit better Staples.
Well, I guess anything's better than that Brooklyn arena. That thing just looks awful. I don't know if you've ever been there. But my friend lives there, and he just says it's just dead. Permanently dead.
I went home around Thanksgiving, and I went to a college basketball game there. Uh-huh. I like the aesthetics of it. Better than the new MSG. I've been to each one once, and I liked Barclays better than I liked MSG.
Oh, interesting.
I'm a really bad Knicks fan, aren't I? I liked Barclays better. I insulted the MSG crowd. What else can I do to disassociate myself with the team I live and die with? Oh, boy. All right, Andy, thank you very much. Appreciate it, and we'll do this again sometime in the future.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man. I really appreciate it.
Nope, no problem. That wraps up this edition of the Podium Game Podcast.